Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Live 100. I'm your host, Tahaka Amana El Bay. I'm Divine Minister for the Moorish American Government. And this evening, we're coming to you straight from the Moorish American Archives by me. And we're going to be dealing with what is the truth behind our wonderful Eurocentric holidays. What historical part the people of African and Moorish descent play in the creation of the American holidays that we celebrate today. Thanksgiving and Christmas is almost here, and shouldn't we be getting ready for the celebration? What is the ancient origin of these holidays? What people were on the earth first, and where is the evidence? What books and authors describe the ancient peoples of the earth? What description did Europeans give about the people they saw when they first arrived in the Americas? These questions are more is going to be answered tonight. And but before we get started, I'm going to make my usual announcement. We have our free articles that we are offering as usual, the 14th Amendment Exposed Commerce Game, How to Play, and the history of the United States and its bankruptcy. And the way to access that is simply contact me by telephone, 904-303-9061, before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We'll get that to you. You can simply email me at tahaka53@hotmail.com, and I'll rush those over to you. Also, we have added some more information in the Tahaka's archive, so those of you who want to give gifts, if you just got to give some gifts, you might as well give your brothers and sisters a gift of knowledge. We have created one of the most comprehensive libraries in the United States, and the way to access that is simply by contacting me at area code 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and we'll get you in there. And it's for adults and children. Your culture is there, your history is there, law is there, the templates and stuff that you'll need is there, and we have personal guidance available to you once you get in there. Keep in mind that on January the 12th, right here in Jacksonville, Florida, we'll have the Moorish Summit. And for information on that, you can call me at the same number I gave at the outset. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be dealing with the subject. But before I do, I want to set the stage for what we're going to be getting into. Let's get a little background information. And I'm coming to you from a book called African People and European Holidays, A Mental Genocide by Ishaka Musa Barashango, Book 2. And starting from page 46, he writes the following. And then came the Moors. In 711 CE, an African people known as the Moors, under the leader Jebel Tariq, crossed the straits, landed on the rock island of Gibraltar, which is named in his honor, and here built a mighty fortress. From this base of operations, they entered Europe, defeated the German Goths, and made themselves masters of Spain. Then the Moors crossed the Pyrenees Mountains and conquered southern France, giving all of this backward region one of the finest cultures Europe had ever had. This great Muslim empire included more land than did the Roman Empire in its heyday. These blacks bought with them to Spain a culture far exceeding that possessed by any of the European people of that time. Black Muslim scholars who introduced into Europe the system of Arabic numerals, which included the zero, were masters of astronomy, mathematics, medicine, chemistry, and physics, and possessed a vigorous knowledge of the classics. These wise and brilliant scholars founded great universities in Spain and initiated a golden age of learning and culture, which slowly but surely eventually diffused throughout Western Europe. Before the coming of the Blackamoors, there was no such thing as the concept of chivalry, of stately court life among the European aristocracy. J.A. Rogers states that while the Moorish kings of Spain were living in magnificent palaces, the kings of England, France, and Germany had homes little better than stables, chimneyless, windowless, and with a hole in the roof for smoke to escape. Around the year 77 BCE, a black general by the name of Douglas, whose name means behold the black or swarthy colored man, was racking up victories through his magnificent military exploits in Scotland. This was Britain and Europe in general during the period of the Dark Ages. I just wanted to add that as a backdrop, because all too often we look at television and we see all of these people on here, and they have all this all these commercials and stuff going on, and we all a lot of us are under the impression that that's the way it always been, but we're going to bring it to you from a whole different perspective this evening, and I wanted to set that as the foundation so that you'll know what we're dealing with. Now I'll open up this first plug, and I see we have someone with the hand raised, and I'll get to you a little bit later, okay?
So often we are compelled by the conditions and the environment we live in to look at things in a fantasy manner, a fantastic way, rather than from the viewpoint of reality. The object of the whole African Senate movement in bringing forth accurate information, not only in terms of history, but every other field of discipline, is to be certain that we as a people are able to be confronted with and be made to deal with and to have the tools, the powerful weapons of reality. Whether that reality is pleasant or unpleasant, we must be able to deal with reality in order to be rational and sane, and to reach that place for which we are being called to go. And that's why we entitled this topic tonight, Holidays from the Perspective of African-Centered Historical Reality. Why historical reality? I'm reminded of the words of Elhaj Malik El-Shabazz, peace be upon him, known to us as Brother Malcolm, when he said, of all our studies, history is best qualified to reward all research. And so it is. When you get into the history of something, then you have a better understanding of what it is, what it was created for, what are its purposes and objectives. So that's why we're approaching it from the perspective of an African-centered historical reality. African-centered because there is, has been, and we are still being subjected to a Eurocentric worldview. And there's still a great and wondrous struggle going on to break the bonds of that worldview. And so now we must do things from what we are, and we are an African people. I know I don't have to explain that to anybody in here tonight. And that's how you see things. It's how you look at things from your experience. We have several premises I would like to discuss with you before we get into the historical elements of the topic tonight. The first premise is holidays are the institutionalized celebration of the thoughts and ideas of a particular philosophical worldview. What does that mean in essence? Not that you really need an explanation of it, but I always have to explain sometimes even what I say to myself. The institutionalization of our own thoughts and ideas and our own creations, part of the process of doing that and helping to keep those thoughts and ideas alive and nurturing us and motivating us in our everyday existence and our everyday struggle and fight for total mental, physical, and spiritual liberation from this beast here, from this hostile environment. As a part of that process, celebrations play a very definite role. Holidays are important to us. But in those holidays, if they do not reflect our life experience, if they do not reflect the positive aspects of our worldview, of how we see the world, of how we understand the things around us, then we have to ask the question, what good are those holidays to us? Should we be celebrating them or should we be celebrating something else? Let me stop here for a minute to discuss something that Dr. Sheikh Anta Diop set forth. And that is the idea, it has always been known to us who have been aware and thinking people and in the process of continued evolutionary path of enlightenment, that there was a quantitative and qualitative difference between the way that we as a people look at the world and the way Europeans look at the world. Brother Malcolm stated it so beautifully and straightforward. He said, when you sit down to the table with the white man to discuss an issue, to discuss an idea, you're not speaking the same language. It was difficult for some of the Negro leaders of that day to understand what he was talking about, because they knew they were saying the same words. They were discussing the Constitution. They were discussing the Bill of Rights. They were discussing the Declaration of Independence and all those things. The white man was using the very same words that the black people were using. However, they were not speaking the same language, simply because they had a diametrically opposed worldview. Diop puts it in these words. It's the difference between xenophobia and xenophilia. And that is, the European has a fear of anything different of other people and cultures that is different from him. And therefore, he must control them in some manner or eradicate them. Like the child who has never grown up, you stop running around here. Here's black men. A big, strapping, Nubian-looking black man that can snatch telephone poles up out the ground talking about, I got to go to work for the man. He's not the man. You the man. He never grew up. And why do I say that? How can I say that? I can say it because Jerusalem Slim, who you call Jesus Christ, we used to call him Brother Jerusalem Slim in the seminary, said that it is by the fruit of a tree that you know what that tree is. What he produces is what you know what that tree is. And the very fact that when people do not do what he wants them to do, he acts just like a little child, like the demon seed. Either you do it or I'll hurt you, or I'll take my marbles and get out of the game. Most of the time I wish he would just take his marbles and go on by his business. But he's not satisfied with doing that. He got to come back and try to control the game again. He's perfectly all right with me because I know left on our own, we really, when we have nothing else to do but on our own, we can do it. And we'll do it fast. We won't drag it out then. But this xenophobia, this fear, is the motivating factor, as Dr. Francis Welton tells us in the book, The ISIS Paper Keys to the Color, is the major motivating factor of white folks. Now, I'm going to come to the holidays, but I got to lay this groundwork here. I hope y'all can be patient with me. One of the reasons is because I have to constantly be defending myself with black folks because I discuss the historical realities of the European. And I'm going to stop doing that. Black folks wouldn't even come out to see me a lot of times until I let some white folks come in. That's why I was so glad to get here. It's one of the few places in the world where I can go where I am totally in an African environment and you don't want nothing else here but Africa. Now, African people, in their natural state of being, and most peoples of color tend to have a xenophilic approach to life. That is, a love of other people, an embracing of other cultures, a sharing of culture. So you have these two different things. So now, when you celebrate European holidays, whose major motivation is the fear of his genetic annihilation, his phobia of other human beings, what type of celebrations do he have? Those celebrations that are built around that worldview, which is essentially xenophobic. When you celebrate that, you are celebrating something opposed to your very nature because you are by nature in your natural state, and I'm saying natural state now. A lot of us didn't got out of our natural state. We didn't breathe the Holy Ghost, as Jesus talked about. If you know what that means, those who understand, let them understand what has been said. And when you are in your natural state, your idea and purposes for a celebration is different. So I wanted to deal with that first premise. You still with me? You all right? The second premise, the celebration of holidays.
Ladies and gentlemen, this evening we are listening to Brother Barashango as he describes the intricate history and background of people of African descent, the Moors, Europeans and their holidays, and he gives us a clear and concise description of this situation so that we will know the effects of what we are doing. Now, Thanksgiving is fast approaching, and then right behind that, here comes Christmas, and behind that, here comes New Year, and then we go into the Mother's Day, Valentine's Day, President Day, all these holidays are from a complete Eurocentric perspective, and it does not have anything to do with people of African descent. Now, see, I have a caller with a hand raised. I'm going to open this line up here. Area code 904. Tell us who you are, where you're calling from, and what's your question or comment. 904, last four numbers, 2884. Close that up. All right. Anyway, let's continue.
Establishes and helps to maintain a strong emotional and cultural bond between you and that which you are celebrating. A strong emotional and cultural bond between you and that which you are celebrating. Anything that you jump up and down and sing about and dance about long enough becomes very much a part of your being, and you feel something for that because it brought you joy at the time that you were doing it. So you have an emotional and a cultural bond and connection with it. The question arises, when we celebrate European holidays, what are we binding ourselves to? Another question on that third premise, on that second premise. The third and final premise here. Holidays are very common and natural to human beings. And you should have times to celebrate. I'm involved in the African liberation struggle until I am taken home to my ancestors. Unless I should lose my mind, and when I do that, somebody please put me out of my misery. Because if Ishaka Musa is no longer involved in the liberation movement, then you know he has gone plumb crazy. And he needs to be taken and worked with and to bring all the African-centered behavioral science to try to heal me and lock me up till I get straightened out. As long as I'm in my right mind, I'm committed to the African liberation struggle. However, I do not view it as a struggle. It said it's the African liberation movement. Because many times when brothers and sisters get to talk about we involved in the struggle, they make it hard for themselves and anybody else who may be interested in it. It is a happy thing that we do, those who are participating in it. We chose that this is the road we would go rather than be manipulated and controlled by something or someone else. Now, that's a happy choice. That's a choice a lot of people don't even know they have. So now the fact that you made that choice, you must be a happy warrior. It must be a joyful task. You fight better when you're happy. Even if you, when it comes to the point where you have to take an enemy's head off, do it with a smile. And by all means, when you talking to your brothers and sisters, always talk up. Always speak hope. Always speak joy. Always speak the fulfillment of the promise that has been given to our mothers and our fathers ever since the days that we were brought off the slave ships here. They knew from generation to generation that this day would come. So talk in them terms. I have it in my household. When I ask my children what happened, they have to respond on demand. Say, what's happening? Black folk on the rise. Don't tell me I don't know. Some stuff like that. And when they forget, I keep asking the question until I get the answer I want. They get tired of it, but at least it's a part of the right programming process, conditioning process. So it's natural for us to be happy and to celebrate. We started out by celebrating the harvest and on our own land when we created the science of agriculture, the success of the hunt. The rituals and celebrations of the rites of passage, all these things are good reasons for celebration. For us, we have a lot to celebrate in that we were able to survive this beast all this time in this hostile environment and still come out with some degree of sanity. I say some degree because, as Dr. Ben says, we are all crazy to some extent, having been here and survived under these conditions. But we're still able to function. And also we celebrated so often victory over an enemy. But never in the history of the world have I ever heard of a people celebrating the victory of their enemies over them. Do you get my point here? They may remember that, but they will not celebrate it. The only people I know now presently in the world is the Negro and other people who are mentally subjugated by white supremacist culture around the world that celebrate their enemies' defeat of them. So when we study European holidays, we have to ask, whose victory are we celebrating? All right, I hope y'all don't get angry with me in here. I don't mean to be a killjoy, but I just have to deal with history, the story, our story, as it is. Now, I'm going to attempt to, and you have to let me know when my time is coming up, because Dr. Benson, I ain't got time. Watch. I have to move with the spirit. And in the spirit world, we don't know nothing about no time to get in there. But I know y'all got things to do, and that, so you have to let me know when I get there, all right? I'm just going on now. We're going to try to deal with five European holidays, some historical perspective on them. And that is, who discovered Columbus? Because he sure didn't discover me. The second one is Halloween, and I forgot what sister, the sister on the radio program, Dr. Felder, with us that day at WLIB, that came up with that, the Night of the Living Dead. Misgiving, a celebration of horrors. Xmas, the merry mess. And even if I don't get to some of the others, I'm going to talk about America's Independence Day, the 4th of July. I'm going to get to that one if I don't get to nothing. Y'all pray for me now. Y'all send out good vibrations so I can hit them. In order to deal with this, who discovered Columbus, and I'm starting out with the Columbus Day thing because that's how they begin the whole holiday season here in this country. That opens the whole thing up. And the reason why I'm putting a lot of emphasis on that this evening is because all this year here in 1992, they're going to be talking about the quincentennial of the coming of Columbus. And they will be bombarding our children's minds with this, intimidating them with this. And their peers will be looking at them and saying, why are you not into this? And we have to give them a strong, sound historical basis and logical basis upon which to say, I just ain't with that. That ain't down. That ain't happening for me. I dish that. That's what they say. And this is the reason why I recommend that. I didn't come here to tell you what to do or to make any choices for you, only to show you the other side of the coin. Some of you have already seen that side of the coin, but it ain't going to hurt us to look at it again. Time period, talking about 1492 now, we must assess here briefly what was going on in the world then. Contrary to what we have been miseducated to believe, the world was not waiting for white folks to come and bring them Christianity, civilization, or any other thing. They didn't need them, they didn't invite them, and they weren't looking for them. They did not need them for anything whatsoever. If you study what was going on in the Olmec and the Mayan and the Aztec civilizations here, and what was going on in China and India and everywhere else around the world and on the mother continent, nobody needed what white folks had to offer. So I want to get that clear. So there was nothing they could bring us but misery, as history has shown. Why do I say that? First of all, I have to go back about 700 years or so before 1492, if y'all don't mind. Talk about one of the great periods of the many wonderful periods of our history on this planet. And that's when the Moors left from the motherland, went over and on the island which later became known as Gibraltar under Gibr al-Tariq. And from their base of operations and their fort there on the rock of Hercules, between the pillars of Hercules, as they call it, they moved now into Spain. They were 80% indigenous, jet black, broad-nosed, thick-lipped, kinky-haired Africans. That is what the documents of history say, not what I say. This is empirical evidence we're talking about here. 20% so-called Semitic Arabs who joined in. The Semitic Arab or Muslims had nothing to bring to the Muslims on the motherland. When they left out of Arabia and were traveling around for their conquest, they left with a little more knowledge than how to raise camels and how to feed, have her sheep. It was only after they went in and conquered Egypt that they now come out with this new life and knowledge. This resurrection of the old classics and the zero and all that. And it was the indigenous Africans still living in what came to be misnomered as Egypt in Kemet there, which introduced them and taught them just like they had taught the Greeks, the Romans, and everyone else who had conquered them. For as Asa here he tells us, they conquered us militarily, but we always conquered them culturally and scientifically, for we had the knowledge to do that. Why, even in slavery, they had to depend on the black slaves to teach them how to do things. So even though we were their slaves, we still had to conquer them morally and intellectually. I want you to think about that. They didn't have to teach us how to read and write when we first got here. We already knew how to do that. It was only the next generations where they had taken that from. But we had to come back and learn that again. Most of them who brought us here couldn't read and write. Now, at the time that these Africans went into Spain, not five kings or queens throughout all of Europe in any of their nations could read or write. Not five were literate. And couldn't anybody read the Bible but a few of the priests who could read, and it was chained to the wall so that only they could read it. The common people did not have it. I'm trying to get you these good God-fearing people with these halos around their head that came over here, killed up the indigenous red man and captured us and brought us the light of God and Christianity and Jesus. Most of them didn't know it, so how could they teach us anything about it? Now, when the Moors came in, they brought with them the light of knowledge and established the first universities there. They also taught geography from globes. That's a matter of record. They taught from globes. And even after they taught in Spain for some 800 years, the Spanish still believed that the world was flat. A hard people to teach. And if you haven't learned that by now, as the song says, if you don't know it by now, you'll never know it. Why am I going through all this? Because the African had been sailing ships up and down the Nile, up and down the Niger, up and down the Senegal River for thousands of years. Navigational science was a way of life to him. That kind of knowledge did not exist in Europe before the Africans, before the Moors went and took it to Europe. I'm sorry we did it, but it happened. Now, in 1310, Mansa Muhammad Abubakar II looked out over the Ethiopian Sea. It wasn't called the Atlantic Ocean. It was the Ethiopian Sea.
Right.
How do I know that? Because I looked at the maps of the 15th and the 16th century. Damn. And others have looked at it. He looked out over the sea. He said, if we can navigate the Niger, he was the emperor of the Mali Empire at that time. He said, if we can navigate the Sahara Desert, we can deal with that Ethiopian sea out there. So he went to work building. He went to work building with a knowledge which had been preserved by the University of Sankore at Timbuktu and other university systems right there in the motherland. And he sent out 200 ships, 100 with crews of Africans, and 100 for supplies to carry them for 2 years if necessary. Now, I mean, if you think you can go on an ocean for 2 years, you bad stuff. You know something. Because the man loved his people, he was responsible for the people, he was the leadership, he wouldn't send them out somewhere, not knowing where he was sending them. And he told them, say, don't stop till you come to land. I know there's land over there because our people have been traveling over there ever since the days of the pharaohs and possibly before. Some time passed by and only one ship came back. And the ship captain that came back, according to the report given by Abubakar's successor, says that his report went thusly. Sire, we traveled and we followed the wind gust that would take us straight across the Ethiopian Sea. But we reached a place where there was a great churning river and an awesome mist. And all the other ships went into that mist and I never saw them again. We somehow got spent out of it and were headed back in this direction, so we came home. So what did Abubakar II do? In 1310, now we have 1311. How far is that from 1492? 1311 now. This black man says, hook me up 400 ships, 200 to carry people, and 200 to carry supplies. see you later. He gave him five and got in the wind. After conferring the emperorship on Mansa Kong Kong Ganga Musa, he was never heard from on the continent again. But the records of the Aztecs, the Olmecs, and some of the other people there kept recorded that a strange group appeared on their land. Hundreds upon hundreds of black men with gold spears and golden shields, and one tall, jet black man with gold in his braids and his hair, golden slippers, stood under a golden pavilion. And the indigenous bowed down and said, "Hail, our god Quetzalcoatl has returned." That's in 1311. Now, before I get back up to 1492, y'all all right? Okay, I don't want to bore you with all this stuff here. Before I get up to 1492, I got a couple more dates. Because it's impossible to talk about Columbus without a whole bunch of other names coming up before you. Of course, we know Cortez, Hernandez, Balboa, and all the rest of them. None of them were noble people. They were not noble men. They were criminals, sea dogs, pirates, and deserve no honor from us. But also there is Prince Henry the Navigator, Bartholomew Diaz, Vasco da Gama, and Jan van Riebeck. Because at the time now that they were preparing, when they were about to drive out, and I got to come back to 1492 and then switch back a minute. I'll be coming back and forth, but you can hang with me. The last stronghold of the Moors, who had been there for some 800 years, and as Dr. John Henry Clark said, it was one of the few times that Africans had partnerships with other people, and they came out all right for a while. The Arabs betrayed us in the end. The Jews we brought into Europe helped to get us out of, the black Jews we brought in, undermined us with the Spanish to help the downfall of the last stronghold of the Moorish Empire of the Kingdom of Granada in 1492. The same year that your boy made his travel, got lost. When they drove the Moors out of Spain, this is what they declared: "We cannot afford to be embarrassed by the superior intelligence of these people any longer. They must not be allowed to get themselves strengthened and come back here again. They will never rise again, and the only way to stop them is to go to the lands from which they emanate and stop them. We couldn't do that before because we did not know how to navigate the sea. We did not know how to build ships. But now that we have run them out of here, we can take the knowledge that they left behind, and we can now go and exploit the world." Not explore the world, exploit the world. And in that way, we can continue to ensure our genetics.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, before we go to the next plug, we are listening to our brother Barashango as he describes the ancient historical story of our past as Moors and the people of African descent from different nationalities, and exactly what happened. And moving on towards you, our current holidays and why we are celebrating these holidays and the effects that this is having on us. I have one call. I'm open up the line, and before we get to the next plug.
Illinois Central Railroad.
Here you go, 401. Can you tell us who you are, where you're calling from, what's your question and comment?
Greetings, brother. This is CM El Stormo Bay. I'm calling from Virginia right now. I'm just listening to the message, and I'm just enjoying the show. And honestly, all that are listening, that's all I have to say, brother, pretty much. I hadn't had too many questions right now. I'm just enjoying the show, brother. Peace and love to all.
Okay, peace, brother.
And so, in 1444, Prince Henry the Navigator leaves out of Portugal and heads down the west coast of our Cape Verde land, commonly known as Africa. because the Portuguese were heading for Africa, the Italians and the French and the Germans were still trading with the East, but Spain couldn't get through to the East because they would have had to fight the Germans, the French, and the Italians to do it. They would have had to fight the Portuguese to get to Africa, so Spain said the only place for us to go is west. No place else to go. But we got to find some land to exploit, or the other nations around us are going to become so strong and so rich, and they will whip us and subjugate us to them. These are Europeans talking about fighting among Europeans now. Prince Henry the Navigator comes down to the Congo and takes back, begins immediately, after taking back four of Mother Africa's children, begins to recommend the slave trade from there, to bring and import Africans into slavery into Portugal. In 1487 to 1488, Bartholomew Dias, another Portuguese, rounded the Cape of what they call Good Hope in southern Akebu land, Tanzania, because I don't know where South Africa is. I look on the map, I cannot find it. I know where Tanzania is. That's what the people who are struggling there for their liberation call it. Then in 1497, Vasco da Gama rounded that cape and found the route they were looking for to India. What it was, these people were going hungry. They were suffering from diseases. They were being decimated by the plague and everything else. So they were going to other lands to find medicines, to find other things for their own survival. They were not going to carry the light of civilization. They were not going to bring people to Jesus. They were not going for any of those reasons. They were going for economic reasons and strictly survival reasons. That's what it was all about. That's why I say when they tell your children in school about the great explorers, no, they were exploiters. They were not explorers. But here's the kicker. I'm going to be back to 1492 in a minute. In 1652, the Dutch East India Company, which was trading in the slaves, most of its money was made from slave trade of African slaves, sent a naval surgeon named John von Rybeck, and he established the first white settlement in Tanzania, known as Cape Town. Now, why am I going through all that? Because African children there who are compelled by the miseducation system, the white supremacist miseducation system of the USA there, the United, the Union of South Africa, same initials as the United States of America, tell these children that they must celebrate the arrival of Vasco da Gama, Bartholomew Dias, and John von Rybeck. And their arrival opened up the door for the destruction of their civilization and the state that they're in now. Now that is mental and cultural genocide. However, many of us here have no problem seeing that in relationship to Tanzania, but we have a problem seeing it in relationship to our experience here in America. And I say, and I hope I can back it up, that to tell our children to celebrate Columbus Day is the same as telling our brothers and sisters on the continent to celebrate the arrival of John von Rybeck. The same equation. Now, why do I say that? Let me give you a little background on Christopher here. Drop my notes down here somewhere. Hold on a minute. I'll be with you. I'm not gone. Let me get a little background on him. First of all, his name was Cristobal Colon. He was a Jew. His parents were Jews born in Spain, who were baptized Jews, Christianized Jews, to survive there in Europe, because the Europeans were running the Jews all over. I mean, they were giving them hell there in Europe. I have to say that. He was a Christianized Jew who was born to a mother and father who was in the weaving business. At the age of 14, he became a sailor and it settled in Genoa, Italy. Now, in his travels to the west coast of Africa and other ships he had sailed on, he learned about several things. One, he learned about the Moors having taught that the earth was round from the globes they taught geography when they were in Spain and they were still using now at the universities in West Africa. He also purchased a map that was used by the Moorish sea kings who had mapped out the route going across the Ethiopian Sea, coming here to what was later to be misnomered the Americas. This was very precious. You ever read in those comic books about finding a map that shows you hidden treasure and people hold it and say, God, that's what he did with that. That's why he could run around saying to the other ignorant ones, the world is round, give me some money and I'll prove it. Well, how you know that? Well, I can't let you know, just give me some money. He was selling the information, the economic thing. When he came to, I'm not going to go through the whole story there with him, but when he came to Isabella and Ferdinand with his plan, they originally had rejected it. But there was one person who came and saved the day for Columbus. And his name was Luis de Santander, a baptized Jew who was finance minister to Ferdinand. And he said to Isabella, who said, well, now I don't have that much money. Maybe I can, to finance a venture like this, I can pawn my jewels. You know, we heard in school that she pawned her jewels. No, she didn't. He told her, you don't have to do that because I have a cartel of moneylenders. Why did he have a cartel of moneylenders? Because one of the few businesses the Jews were allowed to engage in Europe was pawnbroking moneylending. And therefore, they developed a mercantile class, which gave them outreach and connections and networking with other nations. So they had that hookup that by the time of the Rothschilds spread everywhere all over Europe. And they had to finance every war that Europe went into. There. Now, he goes to his cartel, which consists of Don Isaac Abravanel, Juan Cabrero, and Abraham Senor, all Jews. They raised $98,000 to get the three ships for Columbus to come over here. On his way over here, he has to stop, go down, because you can't come over here unless you went down the west coast of Africa. And one of the reasons why he went to the west coast of Africa is a brother he had met when he was there before that would be most vital to that mission, that lived in Sierra Leone. His name was Pedro Alonso Mina, one of the most celebrated navigators in the world at that time. Put him upon the ship, either the Pinta or the Nina, I don't remember which one now. Santa Maria, thank you. And they now come over, they're on their way over here, but they don't go further enough to the south, and the wind can't carry them directly to Brazil, so they're delayed for some time, and it's an arduous journey. The journey is so bad that the crew threatens to mutiny. And they tell him, if we don't see some land soon, we're going to throw your butt off the ship, and we're going back to Spain. Because Colon said, the king and queen told him, he said, man, I can't go back without something. They didn't let me this money because he made them promise to make him admiral of the sea and that he could get 10% of everything he could steal once he got here. It was an economic venture now, I'm telling you. So now he comes. He's not far from land. They're about to commit mutiny. And I understand, I'm told that Pedro Alonso Mina looks off of his ship and he sees floating in the water twig with leaves on it and some blossoms, which is a sure sign that they're not far from land. So he says, hold on, don't mutiny yet. We got to be near land to see something like that. And then a few hours later, they do see land. I'm not proud of it, but the brother saved Christopher Colon's behind right then and there. Now, when he gets here, this is the report he gives to Spain when he returns. He leaves a large portion of his crew here on the island of what was to become known as Haiti. I want you to keep that in mind because we're going to come back to that in a minute. You all right? Y'all so quiet out there. I hope I ain't boring. When he gets to bring his report back to Spain, I know I'm hopping around quite a bit, but I'm trying to cover a lot in a few minutes here. And I read from African People and European Holidays, Mental Genocide, Book 1, page 32. This is the report that Christopher Colon made to his sovereigns in Spain. He's describing the people he encountered here. The people he what? That means the people that were what? Already here. As one comedian said, you can't discover nobody who don't want to be discovered. How are you going to discover something that's already there? He says this, so tractable, so peaceful are these people that I swear to your majesties, there is not in the world a better nation. Do you hear what he's saying? This white man that was supposed to have to come to these savages and stop them from eating up each other and teach them about God and everything and civilize them, he's saying he has never encountered a better nation than what he encountered of these people here. They love their neighbors as themselves. What'd he say? I thought we had to wait until the white man come to teach us that. Love your neighbor as yourself. That's a part of the Christian doctrine. Love your neighbor as yourself. These people already had it. Didn't need anybody to bring it to them. It was already here. And their discourse is ever sweet and gentle and accompanied with a smile. And though it is true that they are naked, now to Europeans, anybody that wasn't covered from head to toe was naked. Because as Francis tells you, they had a problem with their own physical body. African people and people of color like to get that sun, get that rock into them. Women could walk around bare-breasted because they would not be disrespected. Nobody would disrespect. Couldn't do that today because of my mind's been twisted all out of shape. But it was nobody would think to disrespect an African woman in those days. It was unheard of. And it could cost you your life. In some communities today, it can cost you your life. Says, though they are naked, yet their manners are decorous and praiseworthy. Columbus goes on to recommend that these friendly and hospitable people be made to work and sow and do all that is necessary to adopt our ways. Do you take that? Sheer arrogance. To adopt our ways. The people were all right the way they were. They didn't need anything from him. After which he displayed the 10 Taino Indians he had captured and brought to Spain. Now, on his second voyage back, I've got to read something to you. Is that all right? And so some people won't call me a racist in reverse. I'm going to read from a white man this time, okay? Will Durant in the Story of Civilization, Volume 6. This is what he wrote about it. When Columbus returned on his second voyage, after he had left this colony of Spaniards there on the island of Haiti, he returns now and, mercy, hold on again, to this island to see what had happened, what had taken place while he was gone making his report to Spain. This is his second journey now. And it says here that 10 months after leaving these people there, that hardly a man remained of the colony, remained of it. The Europeans, and this is in Will Durant's language now, had roamed the island, robbing the natives of gold and women. They had established a tropical paradise with 5 women to each man. They had quarreled and murdered one another, and nearly all the rest had been killed by the outraged Indians. Now the brothers had opened up their arms and said, come on in, there's plenty, you know. We'll share. These folk acted so bad, they made the Bloods mad there, and they started killing them, which was their right to do. They said they should have slain them at the bay in the first place.
What?
I'm not talking violence, I'm not talking hatred, I'm talking our survival. He goes on to write, he turned back towards Haiti October. He left another colony there now, and he went on to explore some other islands, right? Look for some other islands to explore. Because up until this time, he hadn't found really anything to take home but those 10 indigenized there, which they called Indians there. And Isabella and Ferdinand said, you better come up with something more than that, because we got to pay this $98,000 back to them Jews. So you better come up with something. That ain't going to get it. He turned back towards Haiti October the 29th, 1494, wondering how his new settlement had fared. He was shocked to find that it had behaved like its predecessor, that the Spaniards had raped native women, stolen native stores of food, and kidnapped native boys to serve as slaves, and that the natives had killed many Spaniards in revenge. Columbus himself now became a slave dealer. Let me read that again. Listen very carefully to this. Written by Will Durant, Dr. Will Durant, one of the foremost European historians. In The Story of Civilization, Volume 6, page 265. If you don't have it, go to the library and check it out, please. Columbus himself now became a slaveholder. He sent out expeditions to capture 1,500 natives. 400 of these he gave to settlers. 500 he dispatched to Spain. 200 of these died on the voyages. The survivors were sold at Seville, but died in a few years unable to adjust themselves to the colder climate or perhaps to the savagery of civilization. Brother said over there, civilization. The third settlement that he left here had survived, but one of every four of the 500 Spaniards that he left there in 1496 was suffering from syphilis. And the settlers had divided into two hostile groups that were now on the verge of war. These folks just love war. To appease the discontent, Columbus allowed each man to appropriate a large tract of land and to enslave the natives dwelling on it. This became the rule in Spanish settlements. With him on this voyage in 1498, as he crossed the Ethiopian Sea, he passed Africans on their way back home, carrying cargo. And when he got here, he said, what was that? I saw it. Oh, them the brothers from over there. They've been coming, the Sun people. They've been coming here a long time. They brought us some gold. We gave them some things. They took back. They'll be back later. They do that all the time. With him was one of the most infamous creatures that has ever walked on the face of the earth. Bishop Bartholomew Las Casas. He looked at the situation. He said, these people can't stand up under hard labor. They make their living enjoying life. They fish, they hunt, they weave, they make rugs and things. They can't stand up under that hard labor. We're going to have to look somewhere else. Said, now the Portuguese have Africans, and they can do the work of 10 of these indigos, as they call them. So then he went to the Pope of Rome, the vicar of the Son of God on earth, who once wrote in their catechism, Pope Leo X said, the Lord our God no longer reigns. He has given all power to me. I'm not picking on any bad religion. That's in their history. who had the keys to the kingdom to walk in the shoes of the fishermen and got permission to capture and enslave African people and bring them to the Spanish colonies, which opened the whole door to the slave trade, became the basis of America's economy, which we'll be talking about later on there. My brothers and sisters, I present to you the question, is it logical, is it sane for us or our children to celebrate the arrival of a slaver, a person who dealt in the slave trade, a person who opened the door for the genocide and destruction, not only of the red nations here, but the black nations that were here as well. And then on the heels of that, to capture our ancestors and to bring them here and to subject them to the worst cruelty that has ever been known in the history of the entire world. There is nothing to match this. This is the greatest of all holocausts. Would they tell me somewhere between 150 to 200,000 million lost in the Middle Passage alone, not to mention the suffering wreaked and the destruction on all of the civilizations which were existing there on the continent and the pain and deprivation after we were brought here. So is there that one move by Columbus opened the door to the Western Hemisphere for that kind of activity? So what is there to celebrate in that? I hope you don't get angry with me for sharing that with you. I'm going to leave that alone now. We'll move on to the next holiday. Y'all all right?
Yeah.
You still with me? Let's talk about Halloween, Night of the Living Dead. Yes, sir. Oh, I thought my time was up. Now, in order to get to this, I'm going to have to go a little further back in history. Now, we went back to 1310, 711. I'm going to have to go all the way back 200,000 BP. Now, don't get upset, because I guess you're thinking, say, this brother has talked from 711, and it took him all this time to get to 1492. How long is it going to take him to get from 200,000 back then? Well, I won't be able to give as much detail. I'm just going to touch on some things. But I think it's important to lay this sound historical basis to demonstrate the dichotomy here that I'm talking about in reference to this Night of the Living Dead. Now, paleoanthropologists, anthropologists, and a whole bunch of other scientists are not agreed totally on the fact that the Homo habilis, which existed some 2 million years ago on the mother continent, was really a human being or not. There's still some discussion over that. But the one thing we do know for certain that no sane anthropologist can argue with is that by 200,000 years ago, human beings, Homo sapiens sapiens, modern human beings had developed and had developed nowhere else but on the continent of Akebu land. Now that is a fact that only a fool would try to dispute. That has been proven in so many ways to the genetic system of the biology system. I'm trying to think of the term for that field, through osteology, through so many poring over the bones, through all kind of ways. They have come to that biogenetics, that's what it is. Now, these people who lived some 200,000 years ago produced out of this woman who was to become the mother of all humanity, this queen of the universe who was that all humans and some of her children I'm sure she don't want today, but everybody can trace the ancestry back to this woman. So naturally, if they can trace it back to this woman, and women can't have children by themselves, they must be able to trace it back to a black man, an African. They, sometime between 90,000 and 150,000 years ago, and Sheikh Anta Diop puts it 150,000, began to migrate out of the mother continent to other places in the world, and they covered the globe at that time. They took with them, according to Dr. Rebecca Khan of University of Hawaii, they took with them an special advantage that nobody else on earth had at the time. They were more advanced than anyone else. And I do detail that in my book, African Woman, the Original Guardian Angel, there, and go more in depth on what I'm talking about here now. They encountered another group that was existing on earth at the time, Homo neanderthalensis, who we're not sure whether they were actually human or what. There's a lot of argument over what they were. They were still pigmented of skin, very dark. However, those that lived in Africa had a black hair covering or dark brown. Those who lived in Palestine and Asia had a sort of tannish color, and those in Europe had a reddish color after being there for some time. Now, the great warm glaciation came, as you know, glaciation came about of the Ice Age there about 125,000 years ago. And after that, we find no more of them. About 35,000 years ago, they become extinct. Now, either through the recessive genes process, they become the Cro-Magnon who appears about 20,000 years ago, or they disappear, and this group known as the Nubian Grimaldi, who had traveled there in Europe about 40,000 years ago, become bleached out, and the Cro-Magnon after the Ice Age. What I'm saying, in essence, there was no record of any leucoderm, that's people without skin color, on the face of the earth, no Caucasian whatsoever, before between 20 and 25,000 years ago, and we have a history of African people for at least 200,000 years. Now, why am I raising all this fuss here about that? This is the reason. The Nubian Grimaldi, when they went there into Europe and in Siberia and the other places, we find their bones and their artwork. We find that they had a burial custom and system, which the later Cro-Magnon, the immediate predecessor of the Caucasian race, did not have. It was a long time before Caucasians practiced burial. They practiced cremation because they were nomadic. They weren't sedentary people. They didn't settle on land. Africans had a penchant for land and settling on land. No matter how harsh the conditions, they were going to make that land work for them because they had an attunement with land. Now, in their burial systems, the Nubian Grimaldi showed ritual. There's evidence left behind of the rituals to their ancestors. They had a love of and adoration for their departed, because to the African, until we were brainwashed and conditioned by invaders, there was no such concept as death. You understand what I'm saying to you? There was only the cycle of life, the passing of the rites of passage. And that even though you left your physical body, your spirit went back to the atoms and molecules, to the cosmos, only to return sometime in future children or future generations, or maybe tomorrow at the next child coming in while you're leaving out. How many times have you looked in the face of your children and saw your mother and your grandmother and your granddaddy and so forth? That's because the African never died. So if you never die, there is no fear of death, and that's why our warriors and soldiers of the past were such fearsome warriors, because they didn't have a concept of death. And you can't threaten a person with death, you can't threaten them with nothing. Contrary to that, once again now, we see this difference of worldview. The Europeans, who came later there to be known as, because I don't have time to go into all the history of it now, it's a lot. I cover that in African People and European Holidays, the Mental Genocide, Book 2. There came another group of Africans into that area of Europe, known as Iberians, between 8,000 and 3,000 before the Common Era. And they came to be known as the Celtic Iberians. They were Cushites who came there. They were driven, some of them further north, some of them to Wales and further west and back down into Africa by the invasion of the posterity of the Scythians, who used to go to war wearing a black cape, buck naked. That's historic. And the first person they slew in battle, they jumped on them, bit them, and sucked out blood. That's where the whole concept of the vampire come from. The Greeks later followed that up by going to battle naked and shit. You can look in there in some of these pictorial books put out by Time Life, and they'll show you that. And they were going to battle naked with just the cape and the shield and the helmet, because the first person they came across, they committed homosexual act with them as a symbol of total conquest. So my brothers, we should find ourselves incarcerated in those concentration camps. We not Greeks, we be Africans. And we do not allow ourselves to be degenerated to the level of a beast. So we tuck our nature under, we put our iron nature in the hands of the Creator, and we let our spirit and mind take over. Because the one doing the pounding is as bad as the one that's been over. You're both faggots. Once since the Sapphire find out about that, she should never have nothing to do with you ever again in life. Well, brothers don't like it when I talk like that when I go to them prisons, but I tell them that, man. You up in there doing some of everything, and when you get out, you're going to come home and endanger these women. No telling what you bring in there. If you can't act like you supposed to act and be a man, you don't deserve no woman. That's a blessing, not a privilege. Blessing. Let me get off of that a minute. And brothers, I'm not coming up. I'm a brother. If we don't get this thing set right, we ain't gonna never be men. If we don't view these women the way they're supposed to be viewed and treated, we will never be men. Not ever. It is impossible to come through that unless you treat your mama right. And every African woman at some time is your mama, just like you her father in some capacity. And I'm saying that because, and I didn't mean to get into that, but you can read it in African Woman, the original guardian angel. It does not mean that the woman is greater than the man or the man is greater than the woman. African people rule the world side by side as equals. We didn't get it caught all up into that. That's a European problem. Maybe we can deal with that in the question and answer. I can't get into it now. But let me get on that. I've gotten off the subject. Let me get back now. When these Scythians now began to drive the other Europeans, the Teutons and the Jutes and the Angles and some of the, all the other Germanics, drive them west, they now put pressure on the Iberians that were there, the black folks who were there. And when they took over, they also co-opted the great culture that these black folks had. These were the folks who built Stonehenge and so many other of those megaliths up there in Europe. And I didn't write that. Some English historians out of the latter half of the 19th century, Gerald Massey and Albert Churchward and Sir Godfrey Higgins, who says he was exasperated by the fact that every time he went to study the origin of nations, he always ended up with something black. That's what he said, isn't it? In Anacalypsis, book one. For a long time, you couldn't even get a copy of it. We stirred it up so bad, they figured, well, it's better to make that money. We can always try to take knowledge from them later. They don't know. This is a different time. Well, they came in, and they came to be known as Celts. So you had two types of Celts. You had the black Celts who brought the bagpipe and everything. The bagpipe and everything comes out of an African tradition. And you see it with the African scientific symbol of the god Bes there. And the wearing of the kilts, that was brought in by African people. Well, they co-opted that culture, and they became, there were the Briton and the Gaulish Celts. Most of them settled in Britain and in Gaul. Now, out of them, there came a group of priests known as Druids, who took the knowledge that was left behind by the Africans and once again co-opted and corrupted it. And in place of ancestor reference, they came up with Shawin or Shaween's Feast Festival of the Dead, or Satan's Sabbath.
What is this called?
And during this festival, now note the contrast, Africans pour libation and invite their ancestors to come. Please come, be with us. Come, join us at our festivals and holidays and celebrations. We invite our ancestors, right? Europeans say, please don't come, stay, keep you behind in the ground. Because on October the 31st, which was their new year, it was believed that the earth opened up in the center, all the dead came out and started harassing everybody. Goblins and ghosts and stuff. And they figured the only way they could placate them was to give them gifts. And that's where the trick-or-treat came from. And when that wouldn't work, they even painted their driveways a different color so that they could throw them off. They wouldn't come back to their house no more. They figured if they put on costumes and look like something or somebody else, they could throw them off. This is where the Halloween costume thing comes from. Altogether different worldview we're talking about there. Altogether different understanding about things. We love our departed because we know no dead. They're our ancestors. We love and adore them and invite them to be with us. They're scared to death of the dead. They got to placate the dead. Another group they were frightened of, because the whole European historical experience, and I'm not being hateful or racist in reverse and all that kind of foolishness. I'm telling historical truth. The whole motivation of the European throughout his history has been fear. Fear of everything and everybody. Fear. How do I know that? If you don't say, open the King James Version of the Bible and you will read, fear God and give glory to Him. That is not the way it was originally written. It was honor God and give glory to Him. But he put fear because fear and honor are one and the same thing to him. So working out of that fear, also as a part of the symbolism of Halloween or Hallow's Eve, we find gnomes, fairies, brownies, and things. And actually, they were the Twa people who lived up in Scandinavia, these black people who knew how to, who were metallurgists and were doctors. Knew medicine, knew so many things that the Druids and others didn't know, so they figured they were magical. So in those fairy tales, they're talking about the magical Africa many times. The dwarfs, and then they were sharp people. Smart people. And they could do all those things, and they could make the weapons. They were just like, so they feared them. So that is a, shows their a diametric difference of worldview. You still with me? Okay, I'm trying to get off this on some of the others as quick as I can, all right? Witches. Any woman that knew something that a white man didn't know, whether she was black or white, was a witch in Europe. You don't have to take my word for it. You just go and read the history of Europe. How many women who hadn't committed any crime were burnt at the stake for just eating an apple? Them were some ignorant people, man. They couldn't teach us anything. Some black folks, because you talk so bad about the white man. I'm just telling the history. And if they hadn't acted the way they acted, you wouldn't have to get down on it like that. But I mean, now, you know, it's out there. I'm not backing up off it. I'm not going to carry his burden around. He got to pay for that. I got a planet to redeem. I got time messing around with him. I brought him the religion of Osiris, which they call Osiris. And he said he was going to do better when I converted him to that. And then he co-opted that and messed it up. I brought him the religion of Buddha.
And he said, oh, yeah, I'll get into that, and I'll be a better person. He messed that up, exterminated as many Buddhists as he could and set up Brahmanism, brought in the religion of Judaism under Moses. He messed that up, brought in Christianity. He sure messed that up. Brought him Islam, and he fooled with that. I ain't got no more time for the cat, man. Anybody, I've been fighting for 20,000 years, man. I'm tired. If we've been fighting 20,000 years and we ain't been able to settle this stuff, man, we ain't going to settle it. That's it. So you go on your way and I'm going my way. That's it. I ain't got the energy. After all, you done made the lifespan so short that I ain't got the time to spend. The average African, when the Greeks, when Herodotus went into Africa, when they finally were allowed to come into Africa, when the Greeks came into Africa, they found Africans living to be the average of 120 years old. In the heyday of the Roman Empire, according to Ripley's Believe It or Not, 22 years old was the average lifespan. Anybody living to be 50 years old in Europe was automatically a god. If you were 80, you were divine. But here's the thing, man, I'm going to get back to the witches in a minute. That's the problem with a preacher and a historian. The two get mixed up in there somewhere. If that really made me mad, though, because I'm on my 120, man. You understand what I'm saying? You had 22 and I had 120. Now I'm lucky if I make it to 65. Oh, we got to change this. We got to change this. You didn't do me no good. No good. No, you can't get nothing else from me. I was reading a book on gerontology, and the doctors are saying that you should be able to live to be 120 years old easily. Very easily. How come we're not getting that in our communities and in our neighborhood? Because if we don't control the means of production, we don't control the land that we live on, we don't control what comes into our communities that we have to sustain ourselves with. That's why. So no, I ain't giving up nothing. No more. And with my people, man, when you finish, when you gave them all the love they supposed to have, you ain't got nothing left. So these witches now who had this, African women were the founders of the sciences of the world. And they taught them to the men. Brothers, don't be upset about that. When we document that, you know, Dr. Ben taught you that, and many others taught you that. Documented that. I had to wrestle with it first myself when he first revealed it to me, but I know it's the reality. It made me a better man for it. And the black cat, who's always accompanied, shown with the witches, was a symbol of an African deity known as Heheru, the mother of the harvest. And one of her symbols was the apple and the apple tree. So that's why the two were associated together. When I say, some of my students call it the Barashango dictum, because one of the things that I taught in my classrooms is usually what is good for us is bad to them, and what is good to them is bad for us. The theory of irreconcilable opposites, that's what I call it. Everybody else got theories? I guess I can have one. I'm going to deal with just one more because I want to get off of this and get into another holiday or two if I got time here. You all right? But I can't leave here without talking about the pin the tail on the donkey. And what that means. Now, when you have your children running around playing with blindfold on, pin the tail on the donkey, this is what it means historically. On Satan's Sabbath and other festivals of the Druids, they selected a jackass or goat. And that goat was blessed and sanctified to represent Satan, because up there at that time there was no difference between Satan and God in Europe. It didn't make any difference. Christianity hadn't come in or any of the other things there. So it didn't make any difference to them. And as a part of the ritual, you were blindfolded, and you had to show that you were a committed devotee to Shahwin or Satan by kissing the donkey or the goat smack dab in the middle of. Don't take Shakamusa's word for it. They have wood carvings with that on it. They have it in art books of old Europe where they show that taking place. You don't want to believe. Go to the library, look some of them things up, you'll see it. And some of the encyclopedias on Halloween, they will show it to you. Some other people have written books on it. When the Romans came in 55 before the Common Era, under Julius Caesar, and in 46 under Claudius Caesar, they modified that with one of their rituals, which was the kissing of the tail of the horse at the Temple of Pomona. They didn't have to go smack dab in the middle. Just the hair on the tail. But some kissing was done. I wonder if that's where we got that from, saying that. And we can say it too. And be serious. Especially sister can say it for anybody I ever. So we ought to think about that before we say that to each other. So they brought the tail of it, and so now instead of the child walking up blindfold, kissing the things back dab in the middle of the behind, it pinned the tail on it. So that's what your children are vicariously doing when that happens, brothers and sisters. Let me move on. Let me talk about misgiving for a minute, all right? Got a second on that? Why do I call it Misgiving Day? A celebration of horrors. Because first of all, the good pilgrim fathers that you hear so much about were actually homeless people looking for somewhere to stay. Not that there's anything evil about that, because there's a lot of good people out there that's homeless today. But these suckers have been thrown out of Europe and were considered to be criminals. They didn't come over here to bring the benighted heathen the gospel dispensation and introduce them to Jesus. They got some money to get the ship, the Speedwell, and the Mayflower, and the people who put up the money said, look, when you get there, send us back first all you can take. And whatever else you can take to pay this money back, and we can make profit off this venture. Well, Speedwell didn't make it, only Mayflower got him. And as Will Rogers said, white man said, the pilgrims got off the Mayflower, hit the shore, fell on their knees, and thank God, got up and fell on the Indians. And that's exactly what they did. Let's look at here, brother. So I want you to check this out a minute, man. I know some of you already know this, but probably most of you already know this. Now, Dr. Feller and spirit books are all everywhere. But it not hurt us to go over it again, because every year you go over to George Washington chop down a cherry tree, which was absolute and never told a lie, which was a lie. You can't be a general without practicing deception. Diversionary tactics is a lie. You're making a person think you're over there when you're over there. That's a lie. You can't say this man never told a lie. I mean, generals have to lie to win wars. And he won very few. Didn't win any, actually, until the black folks got in there, but that's another story. And I'm not proud of that either. But check this out. These people come here now. They dock outside on the ship, the Mayflower, and 42 men of the 120-some-odd people they have aboard, 130, 42 white males make a compact to decide what is going to happen in this land. They didn't ask anybody who was living here what was going to happen. They decided it. The white male ego decided it. Not that I'm letting the female off the hook, because I ain't. She spawns them, produces them, nurtures them. They get here, they're hungry, they're starving, they don't know what to do to survive. And who welcomes them, even after the Columbus experience, who welcomes them? The indigenous red man. Come on in, brother. We'll feed you, we'll take care of you. He does it for a year. When that year is up, the pilgrims go back out to their ship. After building them a log cabin, they put a cannon on top of that log cabin that is directed at the Indian village. I'm just using that term for convenience, because I don't like the term. I'm just using that for convenience right now. In 1621, they had their first Thanksgiving celebration for having survived, and Governor Bradford of the Massachusetts colony wrote that most, over 40 some of them had died, and scarcely five or six remained sane who was there. The rest of them were totally crazy, mad. He wrote that. That's what that's documented. It's at the archives in the United States government got it. By the next celebration of Thanksgiving, this is what took place. It was the red man who brought the venison and brought the turkey and all those things. You see these things with the pilgrim and his stove-type hat and some bell gun, and the turkey smiling, walking beside him, and the Indians flipping and dancing because he's so happy this white man and brought him God and Jesus. You sat in the classroom just like I did. When they would talk about the pilgrim with tears running down your eyes, the poor pilgrim. I'm quoting in that prolific historian and writer, Professor Joel A. Rogers here. And he says that the early American whites were cruel. Connecticut whites massacred the Pequot Indians. Infants were torn from their mother's breast and hacked to pieces. The heads of the parents were chopped off and kicked about in the streets, maybe where the Thanksgiving Thursday football game comes from. Governor Bradford wrote, "It was a fearful sight to see them frying in the fire and streams of blood quenching the same, and terrible was the stench and the stink thereof. But the victory seemed a sweet sacrifice, and they, the whites, gave praise thereof to God." I don't think I need to say any more about Misgiving Day now. That was enough for me. They were some of the lowest, most degenerate people. They sent over here to these colonies were mostly criminals. They emptied out Newgate front of a prison, Oxford Gore, and a whole bunch of others there. The daughters of the American Revolution were whores, prostitutes, and harlots. Sent over here. That's what they spawned America with. And you wonder why the American government, even today, in 1991, can't do right? They have a criminal element in them. Why they can't keep crime cooled out? Because they are criminals. They're probably more tolerant of crime than any other nation in the world. Because in their subconscious, they know what their history goes back to. Billy the Kid and all those criminals, Jesse James were their heroes. All criminals. Ponce de Leon and Pizarro, heroes, criminals, committing genocides against peoples. So that's enough about Misgiving Day. Let's go on to Xmas a minute. I know I don't have much longer left. Let me deal with that. Now, I don't want you to think I'm an unhappy man. I'm a happy man. I'm happy, first of all, because I'm an African. Every morning I wake up, I look in the mirror, and I say, thank you. And I mean that. Win, lose, or draw. When black people make me mad, and they can make me so mad, I'm still happy to be an African. It's still my blood. The greatest experience I've ever had in my whole entire life is the African experience. I have not always had the African experience. I'm a born-again African. Because I didn't always know I was an African. And since I've been born again to the Africanness, it is the most wondrous experience I've ever had. And the study of our history is just so overwhelming to me. It just takes me out. And this is a drop in the bucket. We haven't even begun to study this. Our scholars, as great and wonderful as they are, haven't even touched the surface, and they know that. We all know that. Look what we have to bequeath to our children now. The thing can open up, the bull's out the barn now. You can't do nothing. You can't shut the door. They just best going on and leave us alone. They're going to call down God's anger on them, and he's going to use us to demonstrate it. Now, when we get to Xmas, the merry mess. I know some of y'all really get mad with me about that one, because I got to admit, I mean, the music and all that, I mean, that's some, it's the way they portray it, it's pretty, man. I mean, it's simple. It's pretty. I like the music. And every year I used to go to see the Nutcracker Suite. In fact, I conducted the Nutcracker Suite. I still like the music. But when I studied it, went into a historic thing and found out what it was all about, that was based in the Satanism practices once again of the Druids and all that. Now, I don't have time to go on that tonight, but I do discuss it in the book. There were several questions that came up, and one was, first of all, it is not the birthday of Jesus. First of all, it is not. Jesus ben Joseph of the house of Panther, maybe you might want to question me on that, was a black man, and we have empirical evidence to that fact. We're not saying it because we would like it to be so. Because it makes us feel good to think that it is a historical fact. But you can't get around. Even Billy Graham, when they put him on the point in the 60s, said, well, now, what color was Jesus? He said, swarthy. So they stopped and said, okay. Said, well, it really doesn't make any difference, though, because he was for everybody. So they went on with that. And then the swarthy is the German word swart for black. That's what it was. You can't get around that. So here now they take the life of a black prophet, a liberator, because S.G.F. Brandon, in his book, Jesus and the Zealots, a white theologian at Manchester University, he begins the book with the first paragraph. The only thing known for certain about Jesus of Nazareth is that he was crucified as a rebel against the Roman Empire. And Donovan Joy says everything else is theological conjecture. Now that may be the only thing that Mr. Brandon knows, but while I was reading Mr. Brandon, I also read Mr. Rogers. And Mr. Rogers says, moreover, the word Christ comes from the Indian word Krishna, which means the black one. And I also, having studied history, knew that he came from the tribe of Judah, which was the navy blue-black tribe of the children of Israel, and the only one who could reign as a king and be received as a true prophet was he who was kissed of the sun. Because the Israelites, like the Bible says in Amos the 9th chapter and the 7th verse, are ye not unto me as the Ethiopians and the Egyptians, O Israel? We are of the same racial stock. But we don't have time to go into detail, but in God, the Bible, and the Black Liberation Struggle, I give documentation for that. They tell me they used that book in some seminaries around this country. There was an underground movement going on, and those young ministers said, we come out, we're going to start interjecting this to the people. And in some denominations, they have a groundswell coming up where they're telling them they got to take that Eurocentric white supremacist imagery down out of the church. So I am still pushing for that. The reason why, they told me, when I met with them, they said, Brother Shaka, you're one of the pioneers here, and we appreciate what you've done. I didn't even know that was going on. They said, the reason why we seem to be moving slow, brother, is because, and I know why, because some brothers stood up and would tell the people and lost their whole congregation. So they said, we're going slow and feeding them a little at a time. Brother got up preaching it, because see, I'm crazy, it don't make me no difference. You know, if you come, I'm happy. If you don't come, I gotta do it anyway to the day I.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, for those of you who are new, just tuning in, we're listening to our brother Barashango, and we're dealing with African people and European holidays of mental genocide. See, we got a new call in. I'm open up the line and ask you to be very brief. Area code 904. Can you tell us who you are, where you're calling from, what's your question, comment? Okay. Area code 401. Tell us who you are, where you're calling from, what's your question, comment?
It's this is Nassim Malsomo Bay. Still just enjoying the show, brother. Still living in Virginia right now. So I'm just sitting here listening and enjoying the show, brother.
All right.
I'm checking in, all right? Peace and love to all.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we still have a couple of more plugs left, but I just want to interject that on January the 12th, right here in Jacksonville, Florida, we have the Moorish Economic Summit, and so you all need to make your way down here. Also, we created one of the most comprehensive libraries in the United States. The way to access that is simply by contacting me, Tahaka, area code 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m.
By Prince of the Benches, I got to do it. One brother preached, was preaching on the Jesus as an African and his involvement in the liberation struggle, and the next week his church was empty. Last time I saw him, he's walking up down in front of the White House with a sign. That's what they did to him, man. But here you have a black man who was crucified or assassinated for rising up and seeking his people to establish a kingdom of heaven on earth, which is a nation, not kingdom in heaven, but kingdom of heaven, fighting for liberation from the white Roman power structure. And the Romans didn't crucify him as a new prophet. They didn't crucify him as God or the Son of God or the organizer of a new religion. What does it say? He stirreth up the people. The charge was inciting to riot. That's what the charge was. Everything else came later. After Europeans took him over, he became any and everything. Now, Origen and Tertullian and others had taught them, which they shouldn't have done in the first place. We always run over there telling them something and getting the dirty end of the stick. So now, they had a problem they had to face, because everybody in the world of peoples of color, and even many of the white people in Europe, the Jews and so forth, having inherited that knowledge from the Iberians who was there, celebrated the winter solstice, the time when the earth tilts back towards the sun, and we're moving back towards summertime now. And it was on December the 25th, around December the 22nd, and went on through some places December the 25th. And it was the birthday of Horus, or Horu, from which we get the word hero, the son of Osset and Osar, whom they misnomered Isis and Osiris, the birthday of Tammuz, the birthday of Mithras, just about any savior god around the world was born on this day. So they said, these people are not going to let this go, so we're going to have a birthday for ours. They came up with the 6th of January, the 16th of April, several days in April, in August, some days in September, and they finally decided on December the 25th. When did they decide it? 325 years after the fact. When everybody that knew Jesus was gone away from here. Anybody who had some, may have had some birth records, didn't have any more. And how did they get people to accept it? Not through Septimus Dominium. Holy God, Holy Jesus, Mary Mother of God. By the power of the sword. Constantine the Great at the Council of Nicaea in 325. Most everything you believe about Christianity was decided then and there. It was the cross and the sword. They didn't do it by praying. Because the African bishop said, this is not true what you say. Jesus is not one with God. He was a great prophet. They said, you either accept it or we run your behind out of here. So they ran him out. And they established it by the sword there. I think I've dealt with that. I'm not going to deal with Santa Claus now tonight. Okay. Don't worry about my train. I'll stay over if I have to. Don't get this as often. Just be in Africa like this. All Africa. Santa Claus, or Sinterklaas, as the Dutch call him, is another name for Satan. How do I know that? All you have to do is look at the letters and mess with them a little bit and you see that. But also know that who this is supposed to be related to was one Saint Nicholas, who was supposed to be a bishop of Myra in the 4th century of this era, of the Common Era. And he became the patron saint of thieves, pawnbrokers. Children, they threw children in there too. Thieves and pawnbrokers. Because thievery was all right in Europe as long as it was organized. They had guilds of thieves in Europe. In other words, you get locked up if you didn't belong to the guild. They was out there working on your own as an independent. That's when they lock you behind up. But if you were protected by the guild, you could make it. And St. Nicholas was the patron saint of that group and pirates. And he was also called Old Nick, which you don't have to take while you go back and study European language, which was another word for the devil. Because there was always with the European an ambiguous aspect in anything they dealt with. And they had the devil or God or whatever, they were all, and that's why in the mistranslation of the King James Version of the Bible, you will find all of these contradictions. How can a divine, I'm using that term, I don't even like the term God, because the dog spelled backwards, but I'm just using it for convenience now. And there's a whole historical reason as to why. I can't go into that right now. How can a good, loving God, Father, Africans always said Mother, Father God, because you can't procreate nothing, even on the spiritual level, without some female and male aspect. On the European side, that's something. Even the divine creative intelligence in the universe got to hook up in the midnight hour to make things happen. It's a holy thing. When you go about it right. But how can this good, loving Father, as they call him, that could do no wrong, created the world and said, it is good, that is perfect, that created all things perfect, do all that and then have a devil in that world? Now, if God created everything according to their thinking, how in the deuce did the devil get there? If all the creation was done by God, where did the devil come from? You gotta ask that question. It was already there. How could it be there if God was greater than it? I'm asking some questions, and you know why I'm asking this question? Not to pick with you, or not to attack your belief system, because I don't mess with anybody's belief system, but I'm gonna deal with history whether it agree with it or not. A lot of young people are asking these questions, and we're giving them all kind of fantastic and mythological answers that do not make sense to them. And so they are seeking answers in the wrong place. And therefore, if God, and the Bible often says that God caused this evil to happen to this person, caused that evil to happen to that person. How can you be good and cause evil at the same time? What you're looking at is a mistranslation of the ancient text in the King James Version there. That's what you're looking at, a confusion there. So with the European, and I did that to demonstrate that those who mistranslated the text always had that idea that it was really no difference between them, between God and the devil. It all worked in there, together there. Good and evil is whoever could sustain it by the sword that made it holy and righteous and just. There could be nothing no more evil than human enslavement. Nothing more evil than that. Nothing more evil than genocide. But as long as you could do it and get away with it, then you were ordained by what? God to do it. Because God let you get away with it. That's the Europeans thinking, his way of thinking. So this is how now Santa Claus becomes Satan, that used to ride around on a gray donkey. They had a thing about that donkey, man. On Christmas Eve night, when everybody was scared to death because they said that night, too, the goblins and ghosts and things came out and messed with him. And he had this big wazel bowl filled with this intoxicating beverage that he would feed the goblins and keep them from messing with the people. And that's how he became Father Christmas. Also, another word for him is Kris Kringle. Kris Kringle means the birth of the Christ child. Now, this I got to ask you. Now, wait a minute. So let's be logical. Let's put aside belief and all that. Let's be logical in our thinking. How can a little short, dumpy, fat, red suit, white suit, wearing, puffy-faced white man be a representative of or one and the same of the Christ child, born over in a hot land in Palestine, a black boy in a manger in a stable, who eventually was assassinated for rebelling against the Roman government? Where's the connection? But here's the foolishness of it. I don't mean to sound arrogant or anything, but it just sounds foolish to me. Look, these young people are coming to me with this and to us with this. Now, either you're going to deal with reality with them or you're going to lose them altogether. But these fantasies are not going to keep it. They may have worked for you in your time because you didn't know any better. God winked on your ignorance because you didn't know no better. But now the door has been opened. The light is here. And if you fight against it, you fight against yourself. You prick against yourself. In fighting against it. I'm not trying to convert you to anything. I'm not trying to get you to join anything but yourself. I want you to do your own thinking. And you can't do your own thinking unless you know this as well as that. Then you got some information you can work with in your brain computer. Other than that, you'll be walking around supporting their system and keeping them going from now on. That's why God will have to kill you with them too, because you won't let go. So he's going to get them. He and she going to get them. Ain't no doubt about that in my mind. I might not be alive to see it, but they're going to get got. The law of karma is an immutable law. What goes around comes around. Never fails. All you got to do is study history and you will see that. Now, here's the thing that shows the insanity that we have come into since we've been captivated here. You work hard to get money, and you got to do it. You're compelled to do it. It's a sin against God if you don't do it. You'll offend the baby Jesus if you don't do it. Get this money. I got to get this white man this money. And he put you in a state of panic and hysteria. There's only 20 days left to Christmas. Only 15 days left to Christmas. And he come at you through your babies. Because you know, black folks don't like to deny their babies now. It's hard to say no to your babies. And they lacking so much in the world today anyway, so you figure, at least I can give them this little bit of something. I know what you're thinking now. Let me ask you something new. How in the name of heaven do you do all this? You got to work hard, two, three extra jobs, and wrapping packages and mates and stuff. Spending money you ain't got. Wait till the babies go to sleep at night. And here you go with your fools. Oh, shit, get them out. somewhere. They wake up the next morning, their eyes all bright, looking at stuff around the tree. Come here, baby. Look what Santa Claus has done for you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is going to conclude our evening, and I hope that we have gotten something out of this. I've been your host, Tahaka Amana L. Bay, and to our next broadcast, and don't forget to make sure that you're here Sunday for the federal and civil procedures. The brothers will be back so we can continue to get that teaching. But in between time, we'll get you other shows, so look out for your advertisement. Okay? You all have
okay, so your heart's broken. Just sit around moping, crying. You say you even thinking about dying? Well, before you do anything rash, dig this.